fair, warm spring day, late winter day. My name is Charles Marsh, and I'm a professor of religious studies here and the director of the Project on Lived Theology. And I am delighted and honored to have you here and to welcome Professor Claudia Kuntz, who has made a number of wonderful and selfless logistical sacrifices and scheduling arrangements to be with us for a few hours as part of the Theology in the Third Reich lecture series. This particular lecture today is the fourth in five spring lectures. The final lecture will take place on April 17th here in beautiful and warm Jefferson Hall, and it will feature a person many of you know, J. Cameron Carter, who is a professor at Duke Divinity School, author of this extraordinary book called Race, A Theological Account, and Jay will address the theme, Constructive Christian Theology After the Holocaust. Jay has used Claudia Kuntz's work, and I was introduced to your work by one of his graduate students, A.J. Walton, who is now doing his doctorate at Virginia. And I was pleased to hear that you and Jay got together and brainstormed about these two lectures, so that's wonderful. This course has been kind of a pedagogical experiment. We have a graduate seminar that meets weekly, but on these days when we have a visiting speaker, we open up the conversation to the public, and I am grateful to see you all here today. This class has sought throughout the semester to identify and analyze the differing religious responses to Hitler and to the Third Reich in the 1930s and 1940s, to trace the theological commitments and practices of scriptural interpretation as they shaped perceptions of Jews, other non-Aryans, homosexuals, disabled persons, and more generally to understand the complex and I think quite perplexing interrelations of race, religion, and social existence. These lectures are all posted on our website, so those of you who missed the first three lectures, please visit the website, the Project on Lived Theology, and you will see lectures on Martin Luther, the Bible, and the Jewish people, one by Paul Jones on Karl Barth and the struggle against fascism, and then most recently Leroy Walter's lecture on Bonhoeffer confronts Nazi eugenics and euthanasia, all posted in audio files on the website. An expert in 20th century German history, women's studies, and genocide, Professor Kuntz holds a master's degree from Columbia University, a doctorate from Rutgers, and is currently a professor of history, the Peabody Family Professor of History at Duke University. She also serves on the Faculty Advisory Committee of the Duke Human Rights Center, which brings together scholars, students, artists, and practitioners to promote understanding about human rights and social justice, terror, torture, and political violence. You're also currently involved in this Borderlands Center, which I'm so intrigued to know more about. I've already texted Sarah Azaransky to kind of triangulate you on that, so hopefully this will be the beginning of a conversation that's fruitful and last over time. Over the past decade, Professor Kuntz has received research support from a variety of prestigious institutions and organizations, the Guggenheim and Rockefeller Foundations, the Wilson Center, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the German Marshall Fund, Duke University, the American Council for Learned Societies, and the National Humanities Center. Her book, Mothers and the Fatherland, Women, the Family, and Nazi Politics, received a number of awards. It was a finalist for the National Book Award in 1987. It was the Boston Globe Winship Book of the Year Award in 1987. It was selected by the New York Times that year as one of the top 100 best books of 1987. The book that brings her here today and us together is this extraordinary, haunting, and extremely informative book, The Nazi Conscience, which has been a textbook for us this semester. This book was published several years ago by Harvard, and I understand it's been translated. Your Vita says into German, Japanese, and Russian. Is there a German translation in the works?
No. Most Germans read English.
Okay.
And it's a very expensive, and it takes 20% more words to get something into German.
This is true. Yeah. And this book is available on Amazon. It's in paperback. It is fabulous, riveting. Please go order it. You know, not right now during the lecture on your iPhones, but after the lecture. And she is currently working on a transnational study of the debates about the Muslim headscarf in France, Britain, and Germany, and will address generally the subject of Islamophobia later today. Finally, one theme that I want to mention that runs through Professor Kuntz's scholarship and teaching is this: how have ordinary, decent people convince themselves to collaborate with evil and still see themselves as moral? One part of the answer lies in their capacity to imagine that some kinds of people are not human after all. Claudia, we are delighted that you have joined us today to address this urgent and complex theme. So welcome to the heart of the academical village, Claudia Kuntz.
Thank you for that very warm introduction, Charles. I hope I'll live up to it. I am certainly happy to be here. I've never been, I think once years ago I was at UVA, I arrived at night, left in the morning. But this is really my first trip, and I have to say I'm just completely blown away. It's so beautiful. Can you hear me okay? Am I being mic'd? Okay, all right. So this is a bit of a, I'm glad this is a pedagogical experiment here, because I'm going to do a little pedagogical experiment too. And that is, it seems to me, either because it's too boring or because it's a waste of time, if I would read something that I would publish. So instead, what I'd like to do is throw out some ideas for you, which I think you should be a perfect audience to hammer me if you think they're not so good, or engage in you thinking them through better. So the first half of this, my remarks, I'll talk about topics related to the Nazi conscience, and then I'd like to move on, and I don't know, do we take a break partway through?
Sure,
is there?
Take a coffee break.
Whatever. It seems though all the coffee says that you do take a break. Okay. Yeah. And I noticed there's wine there too, but I guess that's for after, huh?
Unfortunately, that's fancy-looking water.
Oh, I see. Oh, well, there we are. Anyway, so I couldn't resist when Charles gave me the topic, Cultural Genealogy of the German Mind, the German mind, to show you the German mind in postage stamps. With, I think, two exceptions, these are all from West Germany. And if you're looking closely, and if your eyesight is really good, you'll see theologians are quite prominently represented. Why are there so many theologians on commemorative stamps in Germany, but not, for example, France? And how many of you, I mean, you can think of all the commemorative stamps that have been advertised. Have you ever seen a theologian, except Martin Luther King, on a postage stamp in the United States? So why do German postage stamps, and I don't know the answer about the United States, but I do know the answer for France. Why are there no theologians on French postage stamps and lots of theologians on German postage stamps? Oh, yes, please.
Well, I wouldn't dare to analyze the German mind in this respect, but of course, France is aggressively atheist as a country.
That's right. In France, you'll notice even now, in the midst of this crisis over the killings, you'll notice the clergy is silent because France is secular. And so one of my points that I'll make in the latter part of my talk today is that, in fact, since 1945, German theologians have become consciously engaged in arguing in favor of multicultural tolerance for all religions. It began with their intercultural, interfaith dialogues with Jews and continues now with Islam. And in this respect, they're like the Archbishop of Canterbury, not the new one, I don't know about the new one, but the old one, who just stepped down, was engaging constantly with Muslim clerics. And part of my project is to do research on the media. And the BBC, from the beginning, positioned against racism respected theologians. When theologians get involved in a dialogue against racism, racism becomes a moral failure. It becomes a sin or immoral. In France, that perspective is missing because the clergy stays away from any kind of political topic because of the Constitution. They are secular, they live in a world apart. Now, that doesn't mean, I'll get back to my topic, I can't resist the little side swipe. That doesn't mean that French taxpayers don't pay for the upkeep of all French Catholic school buildings built before 1905, or that the French government does not subsidize all courses taught in Catholic schools that conform to the national curriculum. There's a little hypocrisy there. But it does mean that France is rigorously secular. Okay, now I'm going to, have you seen enough postage stamps? Okay, let me just, when I saw the German mind, I thought, well, you know, the German mind seems a little bit, oh, come on. Oh, stop. Okay. No. Yeah, sure, save it. Okay. All right. Oh, this is a new computer. It always asks me, have I enrolled my fingers yet? It's an anti-theft device. And one of these days, I have to enroll all five fingers on my right hand in order to get this to go away. This is just not staying tight. Okay, this is going to work. Okay, so to get back to the Nazi kitchen, I want to ask all of you in the seminar, I'll ask you to talk about the papers you wrote for this week, because you did your response papers, and after all, here I am the author, I want to know what you said. But just before we get there, I'd just like to say that theology, by definition, confronts the temptation to evil and the summons to do good. And clerics are charged with restraining the former and promoting the latter. And I want to ask today what we can find out about Christian attitudes towards its two rival Abrahamic religions, the two Semitic monotheisms, Islam and Judaism. And you probably noticed I forgot one postage stamp deliberately. For those of you who aren't close enough to see, this is a rather girlish picture of Hannah Arendt. Even if you do see, you might not recognize her as Hannah Arendt. Anyway, Hannah Arendt in 1945 said, quote, famous quotation, "The problem of evil will be the fundamental question of post-war intellectual life in Europe. As death became the fundamental problem after the last war." Think back to the 1920s, think about the poetry, the fiction, the memoirs that poured out, particularly in among the victorious nations, not only, about death after World War I. And Hannah Arendt was wrong about the aftermath of World War II. The problem of evil did not become the fundamental question of post-war intellectual life in Europe, at least not for several decades. The mass death of civilians, Jews, gypsies, disabled, dissenters, etc., aroused no particular interest. Karl Jaspers, who of course knew not only Heidegger but also Hannah Arendt, wrote immediately after the question of German guilt. Extermination did not figure large in this book, And the noted historian Friedrich Meinecke, who lost the editorship of a journal in 1933, dodged the question entirely. And then in the 1960s, a pair of psychoanalysts wrote a book, very popular book, called Talking About the Germans' Inability to Mourn. So this could be a whole separate class, but it's not going to be. I want to just talk briefly about two trials, the Eichmann trial and the Auschwitz trial, at the beginning of the 1960s. In 1962, Hannah Arendt famously wrote pieces for the New Yorker magazine on Eichmann, and that's where she coined that unfortunate term, the banality of evil. And I would just like to say briefly in passing and not dwell here, we can talk more later, Hannah Arendt, first of all, left before the closing arguments of the trial, and so she didn't ever fully hear Eichmann in his racist self. Hannah Arendt overlooked the depths of Eichmann's racism, washed racism out of his motivation, made him into just an obedient person, which I think was distorting. Eichmann was passionately devoted to the extermination of racial enemies. The 1963 to 1965 Auschwitz trial in Frankfurt also had a paradoxical result. 22 men were charged with terrible brutality in Auschwitz. And actually what turned out is that those men, I think there were five of them, who were obviously brutes, who clearly had a record of sadism, were charged with life. Some of them even got life plus 5 years or life plus 8 years. But most of the men on trial were either exonerated or had short sentences that were commuted afterwards. Now, why was that? By differentiating between those perpetrators who just did their jobs, earnest, good people, didn't go out of their way to be bad or good, and those perpetrators who obviously enjoyed it, the Auschwitz trial created a stereotype of the perpetrator as the atypical sadist, the radical, the brutal guy. There was one particular sadist guard named Bulger who became prototypical of the perpetrator. Now, when the perpetrator becomes sadistic, well, that lets everybody else off. So there are two trials with very different outcomes, the Hannah Arendt outcome and the Eichmann trial and the Auschwitz trial. The Auschwitz trial made the perpetrator into an absolute sadist and everybody else into just sort of anybody, good guys. And the Eichmann trial made Eichmann himself a kind of mindless bureaucrat. Clever, but mindless. So that Judeophobia got erased. And I'm using the term Judeophobia to see how you react to it. Instead of using anti-Semitism, I'd like to see if it's possible to change our vocabulary. It might not be possible. And talk about anti-Semitism as having two forms against the two rival Semitic religions. And so I would like to talk about Judeophobia and Islamophobia and call them both forms of hostility towards Semitism. Okay. Now, there was one man who did not for a second believe that Germans were banal. His viewpoint was very different. His name was Jean Amery. He was born Hans Meyer to a Catholic mother and a Jewish father who died in the First World War. He grew up in a tiny little Austrian town, not even really thinking of himself as Jewish, and he was arrested, like Primo Levi, for resistance activities, not because he was Jewish. And as a result, he had an unusually horrifying encounter. He was tortured and tortured and tortured in Belgium. And so his bitterness after the war came probably at least from his own special experience of evil. And after the war, he was outraged, as were so many survivors, but he was more vocal about it. He talked about the Germans. He said the Germans saw themselves as absolutely victims who had courageously endured Stalingrad, bombing raids, occupation, and dismemberment. They felt sorry for themselves. And actually, Amery committed suicide in 1978, just before the Holocaust emerged in public memory in the television miniseries of that year from Hollywood called Holocaust. So the paradox is that the survivors felt guilt, not Emery, but most survivors felt survivor's guilt, but the Germans felt guilt-free. George Krenn in 1987 summed it up. He said he couldn't explain what he called the poverty of contemporary ethical theory, which is unable to deal with the individual acts carried out in the service of the state and to a lesser extent in the service to an ideology. How does ethics come to terms with that? And we know this is just a quick rundown. We know there's at least three different attempts were made in the 1960s to explain Germans' obedience, except they were all tested on Americans, and they hardly ever got to Germany because Americans proved so compliant that they thought they didn't want to compare them with anybody else. They were also, they were offensive to the freedom, the autonomy of the individual subject. Okay, Theodor Adorno believed that the authoritarian personality, people were predisposed because of their inner psyches to become obedient, and they had a test for that. Stanley Milgram believed that you obey orders from an authority that's a credible authority, like an elected official or an expert or a doctor. And Philip Zimbardo in the 1970s did the famous Stanford prison experiment, and he came to the conclusion that authority doesn't come from the top down, it's horizontal. Peer group pressure enables people to obey orders that are immoral. But none of these answers were really very effective. And let's cut fast forward to a good colleague and friend of Hannah Arendt's, who near the close of his life, he taught at the New School. He escaped from Nazi Germany. And in the mid-1993, he reflected on the failure of philosophy and high ideals to protect intellectuals from collaborating with evil. He wrote a collection of essays. The subtitle was "The Search for Good After the Search for the Good After Auschwitz," and he recalled his mentor, Heidegger. Heidegger, he said, quote, "Heidegger had yielded when the most profound thinker of my time fell in step with the thundering march of Hitler's Brown Battalions. It was not merely a bitter personal disappointment, but in my eyes, a debacle for philosophy. Philosophy itself, not only the man, had declared itself bankrupt." But he also remembered another professor, he didn't respect him quite the way he had once revered Heidegger. But in 1945, Hans Jonas looked up his old professor, Julius Ebbinghaus. Has anybody heard of Julius Ebbinghaus? No. That was Jasper's point, too. But he found him, and he looked him up in the ruins of 1945, and he said, "How did you manage to do it?" Ebbinghaus had resisted. Ebbinghaus had not changed his course an iota because of the Nazis. He had not bent. He was, and I'm quoting Jonas, "a strict and uncompromising Kantian." He had resisted. In 1945, Jonas asked him how he had managed, and Ebbinghaus answered, "He looked into my eyes with that old fire of absolute conviction, and he said, 'But do you know what, Jonas? Without Kant, I would not have been able to do it.' And I suddenly realized," says Jonas, "I suddenly realized that theory and life were one," unquote. But then he stepped back in the 1990s and he said, well, what does that mean? That this creative genius whose profundity had not protected him lived quite unscathed by his collaboration until for several decades after the war. So here's a creative genius who fell for the Nazis, and then, I'm quote, paraphrasing, "an unoriginal but upright colleague who remained pure." And Jonas said, I can't answer that, but it remains a challenge for the philosophy of the century. And he avoided an answer. So let's think about theology, philosophy, good and evil. Arendt actually wrote her dissertation on St. Augustine. Do you call him saint when he talks about him as a philosopher? I'm not sure. I didn't grow up Catholic, so I never know how to even pronounce his name. Anyway, so Hannah Arendt was deeply involved with good and evil from her graduate days. And the thesis of the Nazi conscience is that actually we should pay more attention to the informal structures of knowledge that give people their sense of meaning in the world. We should think less about formal ideology and more about popular culture, for example. Let's see if I can. Okay. And so I was thinking about this, and this is where I want to stop and ask. May I ask a question about Nazi conscience? Did any of you have any questions when you read it? Did it remind you of any other dilemmas in any other time? What did you write in your response paper, those of you, there are 14 of you here, I know, who had to write response papers. What did you say? I mean, it's really, I hate this when I'm up here and you're there, but isn't anybody going to speak out? Come on, look it up. You have it there. I can see you do. Did you read the first chapter I read, I had to thank Charles actually for making me reread this because I hadn't really read it since I finished it. And the first chapter I read was the Heidegger, Schmidt, and Kittel. And I looked back and I said, you know, that's probably still my favorite chapter because it's so troubling. So what did you think about this theologian Kittel? Yes.
Oh, I get to talk into a microphone.
Yeah, sure, I think so, yeah.
Later on in the semester, and particularly after we read your book, it became very clear that it was not opportunistic, that there was some sort of genuine desire within his ideology to switch his research over to theological research that supported the Nazis. And that was amazing to us.
And that's what Jonas discovered, too. Jonas, in this same essay, goes through his philosophy and talks about what Heidegger fails to mention, what he does mention in Zeit und Sein, and really goes through the philosophy of it. Anybody else have a comment?
Come on, guys. With so many good comments, it's great.
Oh, you've got a roving mic. Okay.
Yeah, I got this one.
Okay, AJ will be the roving mic.
What do I think? Do you want to know what I thought specifically about the theologian aspect or just the book in general?
No, on the question of good, of the intellectuals who sold out, because the racial experts also sold out. The whole book is about decent people who sold out.
Mm-hmm.
And theologians are just the most surprising example because I at least used to have higher standards for them. Those standards, I leveled the playing field as I was doing the research, but... Yes, here's a question.
Okay. I was more impressed or like more surprised by Hitler's ability to convince like such a wide variety of people. I was just more impressed with his like clear, I mean, that's what I read about, just like his brilliant psychology and expertise in speech making and just like how he must have been brilliant in order to convince such a wide variety of people to follow him and that he was correct.
It's like he was a built-in, before the word Madison Avenue even existed, that he already understood about PR and advertising, product placement, branding, the whole thing. Except celebrity journalism, I think, was the one thing I did mention. It's quite amazing. The way Hitler combined theater and politics in a way that seems, what can I say, right, very real today, doesn't it? Any other comments?
I didn't necessarily talk about the theologians. I just talked more about the
some other forms of formation that went down to even children's education, but it began and had its support from the theologians, but I didn't necessarily talk about them in particular.
Yeah, the educators are pretty depressing too. In fact, I didn't even reread that chapter. I've been to, been to a few faculty meetings recently. I thought, yeah, better not. Anyway, so
I have a question.
Yeah. Oh, please, you don't have to. It's okay.
So, you said before that this guy sold out, but I thought one nice thing about your book is actually that sold out is not exactly the right word. Because it's not that Hitler kind of manipulated them, or they did it to get a chair in a Tübingen university or something like this, but that actually people have values, and they can use their values in many different ways, and through their values they can justify anything, good things and bad things. So I think in the introduction you say Auschwitz was paved by good intentions, by which you meant not good intentions, but by values. These people believed in a good world, they're going to build a good world, a better world, and the better world meant to exterminate a lot of people. But they had values, and we have to look at it as in their subjective experience, values. So
Thank you, Ellen, because that is one, because I was saying sold out in a little bit careless way, because they didn't feel they were selling out. It's like the paradox of what happens when somebody gets bitten by the ethnic identity bug. They think, oh, I'm a Serb, thereby joining the collective, merging their individual in the collective, and then they say, I found out who I really am. So that you discover your individuality in the collective. And then to come back to unify these two comments, Hitler was in a way like a used car salesman. Somebody comes in and says, I want a station wagon. The car salesman doesn't have a station wagon, but he describes that sedan in the most station wagon-like way. So that he intuits, because these leaders that we're talking about, and Hitler was not the only one, George Mossy called them opportunistic, that they'll pick up whatever is in the atmosphere and turn it to their ends, because they'll hear what that audience wants to hear. And that's why it's a great advantage not to have a consistent ideology, because it's protean and people can take what they want out of the whole thing. So that thou shalt not kill, love your neighbor, do unto others, can all remain intact, and you can see yourself. This is actually something I figured out when I was writing Mothers in the Fatherland, that you can separate who you are inside from what you do. And you can still feel decent, even as you are doing evil. So one of my goals in the book was to talk about the authority of knowledge and expertise and authenticity in structuring people's world's views. And it isn't just obeying somebody in a white lab coat or in a military general's uniform. It's about structuring the knowledge that people have around them. And I thought one of the things I would do here is to do something I couldn't do in the book, and that is introduce the power of visuals. And particularly, why is this? Try something different. And because in a book you can't put enough illustrations in. 76, I thought, really was a triumph. But you can't put, and I had no color, and obviously you can't put in a video, so I brought some videos in with me. But let's think about some of the qualities that Christians attribute to their rival others, their Semitic others. And so here are a few that I thought of, and I'd like to run through some Nazi, not propaganda. The most powerful propaganda, Goebbels said it many times, the most powerful propaganda is invisible. People don't see it as propaganda. That's why product placement gets so much money for different brands. It's Starbucks. If two people in a movie are having coffee at Starbucks, well, you don't think of that as being a Starbucks ad. But of course it is, and it's more powerful. Okay, so here are some of the qualities that are projected onto the rival Semitic religions. First of all, they're not transparent. We can't understand them. But note, they are not open. Actually, it really means we can't understand them. There's a veil between us. Even if there are small numbers of them, they're dangerous because there's a conspiracy. They're dishonest. They're not honest like we are. And hence, there's often a moral panic. There's a whole sociology, a subfield of moral panic. And that happens when, somebody like Jack the Ripper is loose, or teddy boys in England seem to be driving their parents crazy. And I'm calling what's going on in France about the headscarf and about the niqabs as a kind of moral panic. When a minuscule number of cases sets off a huge media response, and we can come back to more examples of that, particularly this week in discussion, but let's keep going. Okay. The Nazis, the racial Nazi theorists, used the language of biology. But actually, biology was bankrupt. They never discovered a blood type. They never discovered a head measurement. They never discovered any physiological way of defining race, and always relied on culture, starting with the baptismal certificates of your four grandparents. But the language was biological, and that makes a difference, because it's not like Islamophobia today is based on cultural essentialism. And so it's openly cultural. The Nazis' language of biology was that you had to judge by appearance, but you called the difference hardwired. We'll see some examples of that. And it's that ambiguity that gave academics such good career options. Because most people are baffled by ambiguity, but what do? We write another grant proposal. We love it. These categories that blur, that don't quite match, it's great. So culture, not biology, identified Jews over and over again. And think tanks proliferated. I know I mentioned five of them. Ellen Steinweiss wrote a very nice book called Studying the Jew on these academic racial theorists. Their culture, that is the Jewish culture or the Muslim culture, like the communist culture in the Cold War, is collectivist. It pushes down individualism, whereas we love freedom. So they're collectivist, they're not transparent, and they don't value freedom. And it's very, very important, I think, to immerse ourselves in the visual culture. And I'm going to show you three film clips that are pretty horrifying, but not quite yet. And everywhere, experts are important. Now even more. Talk shows. I heard some radio programs this morning on the way up. I learned about demons in one, the devil at work in another. I guess at home I don't listen to them. The channels are probably there, but since I got uprooted from my own home single radio station, I was surfing the religious channels on my way up here, AM and FM, and I learned a lot about devils and demons, I'll tell you. So people are longing for expertise. And these preachers were going over the Bible. How did Jesus get out of the crypt to get up to heaven? Some people say he didn't really die on the cross. This is intricate. This is 15 minutes of did Jesus really ascend into heaven? Or I thought it was just amazing. So experts are really important. That's what involves people in the facts. One of the most important sources for evidence against the other, Jew or Muslim, are members of the Jewish or the Muslim faith. These are the people who Hannah Arendt memorably called the exception Jews. In Origins of Totalitarianism, she described them. She said they convert, And then they smell, Hannah Arendt writes in a way I can't speak, and I should have quoted it anyway. So they smell the sweet smell of success, and they begin to speak out against other Jews. And that material, self-criticism by Jews like Walter Rathenau, becomes grist for the Nazi racial studies experts. So they use Jews' critical statements about themselves as evidence. They also pirate or plagiarize Jewish research about Jews, and they're forever quoting the Talmud to give authenticity to their views. Okay. And then, of course, there's statistics. When you have absolutely nothing to go on but your cultural gut instinct, there's nothing like statistics to drive your point home. So, okay. And the beginning of race begins with the face. The face, a mirror of the soul. What all these experts did is to package common sense prejudice as respectable knowledge. And so I'm going to show a couple of minutes from some National Socialist educational materials. The first is The Eternal Jew. Probably most of you have heard of it. It was an exhibit in 1937 in Vienna. It became a film with two versions designed after 1940 to be shown in the newly conquered German territories in Europe as well as at home in Europe. And this is a documentary film made by experts. And if you can get by the movie-tone voice of the announcer who's explaining everything, and if you can think about the Super PAC ads of today, So don't just watch this and say, isn't it stupid? But let's try to look at this film with the kind of critical literary faculties that we'd have if we were reading a short story or a poem. And I should say also there are two very well-known theorists, Emmanuel Levinas, who is a French philosopher, who believed that empathy began with the face. And W.T. Mitchell, so the visual studies theorist, said the face is the primordial element of the human. And so the face is everything. So the idea of the face as being central was not just an idea of the Nazis, okay? One more thing, real quick. The other thing that the Nazi experts did was to, what literary theorists call, read the Jewish sources against the grain. To take what the Jews wrote about themselves and then say, oh, look, there's a hidden criticism. As historians, they redid the chronology of the world. So the 1933 they hoped would displace 1789, for example. And the Dreyfus Affair became an example of a Jewish plot instead of the opposite, etc. My favorite, though, is some Alan Steinweiss discovered Walter Dornfeld, who measured the skulls of Jews, of 2,242 Jews in the 1930s, and he mimicked Franz Boas's American anthropologist 1911 measurement of skulls of children in New York. Boas was measuring children of immigrants and children of native-born parents in order to show the deprivation, the physical results of deprivation. The Nazis, or Dornberg, Dornfeld, decided to do what Boas did, a Jewish anthropologist and a very respected one too, and to do the same thing with Jewish children to show that differences were innate. So he took Boas's experiment, footnoted Boas, and then revised it, and called it revisionism, of course. Okay. This is some of the This is a film, one of the most popular films, based on a novel by a Jewish author, Jew Sweet, Yud Sus. And there's his author, who also became a postage stamp in the DDR. The publicity was targeted, audience specific. So this is more mass market audience. This is a film going audience. Two different films. I think that's Peter Lorre on the lower right hand side. This film, The Eternal Jew, was advertised in different ways to different audience segments. Okay, so let's look at this. And
vor vier Jahrtausenden schon sehen wir ihre hebräischen Vorväter auf der Wanderung.
You can't.
Aus dem Zwei-Ströme-Land wandern sie am Meer entlang nach Ägypten, wo sie für einige Zeit einen Schwungkarpfenhandel mit Getreide betreiben. Als sich die landbauenden Ägypter gegen die fremden Wucherer und Spekulanten zur Wehr setzen, wandern diese wieder aus und treten nun ihren Beutezug ins gelobte Land an, wo sie sich niederlassen und dessen rechtmäßige und kulturell höher stehenden Besitzer schonungslos ausplündern. Hier entwickelt sich im Laufe von Jahrhunderten aus dem orientalisch-vorderasiatischen Rassengemisch mit negroidem Einschlag endgültige Mischrasse der Juden. Uns Europäern fremd, aus gänzlich andersartigen Rasseelementen geboren und verschieden von uns an Leib und vor allem an Seele. Wir würden uns wahrscheinlich nicht in dem Maß.
Okay, now I mean, notice incident how pictures, this looks empirically based. The Poles and this Polish Jews in this picture were, they were photographed after the occupation of Poland, and they were people who had been rounded up in some of the first roundups after 1930, after the invasion of 1939. Okay, it goes on, but I want to cut ahead a little bit to, incidentally, I think, isn't it fun to see the mapping done way back then? Okay, here we go, I think. No? Okay.
...im 20. Jahrhundert unaufhaltsam Länder und Städte Europas, ja der ganzen Welt. Parallele zu dieser jüdischen Wanderung durch die ganze Welt bieten uns die Massenwanderungen eines ebenso ruhelosen Tieres, der Ratte. Die Ratten begleiten als Schmarotzer den Menschen von seinen Anfängen an. Ihre Heimat ist Asien. Von dort aus wandern sie in riesigen Scharen über Russland und die Balkanländer nach Europa. Mitte des 18. Jahrhunderts sind sie schon über ganz Europa verbreitet. Gegen Ende des 19. Jahrhunderts nehmen sie mit dem wachsenden Schiffsverkehr auch von Amerika Besitz und ebenso von Afrika und dem fernen Osten. Wo Ratten auch auftauchen, tragen sie Vernichtung ins Land, zerstören sie menschliche Güter und Nahrungsmittel. Auf diese Weise verbreiten sie Krankheiten, Pest, Lepra, Typhus, Cholera, Ruhr und so weiter. Sie sind hinterlistig, feige und grausam und treten meist in großen Scharen auf. Sie stellen unter den Tieren...
What do you think of that? Try to imagine yourselves as maybe only having seen two or three other talky movies in your life. You only have heard silent movies, maybe some talkies. It's 1940, so you would have... What are the messages being conveyed there? It's very crude, I know.
I mean, for one thing, Jews are dangerous and carry diseases and can destroy your... I mean, they're like rats. You don't want them around. They carry them. They're sickening.
Right. This is,
and they're taking over the world. Right. You have to stop them.
And you know, when you're writing a book, you can describe a movie like that. And I think I tried to, but you can't really capture it until you see it. And even though this is already, what, 70-some years ago, and the technology is totally obsolete, it's in the movie tone voice could drive you crazy, still, it has a certain power. And the next clip I show you is going to be, oh, and this is from the Stürmer, the terrible anti-Semitic Nazi Stormtrooper magazine, and here's a map of the same thing. Of the Jews, and its statistics, its mapping, it looks empirically real. So that the metaphor of the rat and the Jew is a visual metaphor that connects them, and here's the map that connects them as empirical data. And of course the data is not too far off, but a little bit. Okay. Now, the film, The Eternal Jew, also, like Leni Riefenstahl's production, intends to be kind of like a Wagner opera, that is a total artistic experience. So the credits are almost like a symphony. It's very pretentious, and I'm going to show you a little bit of the beginning, and one of the, and then I'll cut to the middle and show images, sound images, of Jews in Warsaw who you can't understand. That builds up the idea the Jews are not like us. We cannot understand them. And so I'll show you just a little bit of the pompous beginning. Dr. Teuber. To the Eastern European Jew, who is different from us. Five.
Und komischer an diesen fragwürdigen Gestalten des Ghettos. Wir erkennen, dass hier ein Pestherd liegt, der die Gesundheit der arischen Völker bedroht. Richard Wagner hat einmal gesagt, der Jude ist der plastische Dämon des Verfalls der Menschheit. Und diese Bilder bestätigen die Richtigkeit seines Ausspruchs. Zusammenleben der Juden zeigt einen auffallenden Mangel an selbstschöpferischer Zivilisationsfähigkeit. Auf Deutsch gesagt, die jüdischen Behausungen sind unsauber und verwahrlost. Man muss bedenken, dass diese Juden nicht etwa arm sind. Durch jahrzehntelangen Handel haben sie genug Geld angehäuft, um sich und ihrer Familie ein sauberes und behagliches Heim schaffen zu können. Aber sie wurden. Der Hauptteil des jüdischen sogenannten Gemeinschaftslebens spielt sich auf der Straße ab. Sehr selten findet man die Juden bei einer werteschaffenden Arbeit. Auch hier geschieht es nicht freiwillig. Die deutsche Militärverwaltung hat sie zu Aufräumungsarbeiten angestellt. Man merkt es ihnen an, dass sie Arbeit nicht gewöhnt sind und auch nicht lieben. Aber das ist nicht Hilflosigkeit, die zu bedauern wäre. Das ist.
And this is the part, you can hear them talking, but you can't understand them. They don't rise to the level of human speech. Okay, what is there to say about these? What do you learn from seeing and hearing that you didn't know before? If anything, maybe not. Maybe it's, I mean, this is an experiment, right? Is it worth it to look at these films, or is it enough to just read in descriptions of what they do? Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah, sure. No. You first, yeah.
I was thinking that, you know, film is something that's either meant to, like, entertain, but in a documentary sense, it's also meant to inform. And so, like, just looking at the images, it's like almost, you could almost replace Jew with, like, an animal on, you know, on a safari trip. And so I think that what the film does is even more effectively shows how displaced the Jew was from the Nazi mindset. So I think that's, I don't know, maybe that's a trivial thought.
It is, but it's like they went on a safari to the Warsaw Ghetto. Incidentally, if you ever want to read a stunning description of the Warsaw Ghetto, read one chapter in Jan Karski's The Story of a Secret State, where Jan Karski smuggles himself into, he's a representative from the government in exile, he's not Jewish, smuggles himself into the Warsaw Ghetto and gives a searing, so it's Story of a Secret State, 1944. Somebody had a, yeah, right thing.
Yeah, kind of, just do you have that the mic? More powerful than even like an image, because it's that just one degree closer to that human being there right next to you and hearing somebody say things to somebody in front of you. It's more jarring.
And probably if you're a West German or a West European, you've never probably met a Jewish person in your life unless you live in an urban area. Or maybe you met one or two, so that you don't have a lot to compare this with. But did you feel like this was a you are there kind of experience?
Mm-hmm. Watching it on film adds just another layer that I think is important. Mm-hmm.
No matter how descriptive writing can be, mm-hmm. it could be construed as a figment of somebody's imagination. But when you see the film, it's real. And it is really, this is life as described by the narrator.
Because it feels like you are perceiving reality directly. You don't see the intervention of the author.
The author is a third party.
Right.
Here you're right there with them.
It's you and them. And then there's somebody back there.
Yeah, so I had read about, you know, the language of rats or roaches or, you know, those kind of animals, being that language being used, but I'm kind of, the fact that it's so, I mean, I kind of can't believe how overt it is in this, that like if it wasn't so tragic, it's like almost silly the way they're using this, it's like how, and the fact that that actually was receptive at all seems to show that the, you know, anti-Semitism or, you know, Judeophobia must have been pretty deeply ingrained already in order to have anything that overt, you know, have any kind of impact on people. So it must have been like very much in place already, I think.
And don't you, this is to get back to your question, that sometimes doesn't it seem as if with Schmidt, Heidegger, and Kittel, that these were men who had understood it was not polite to express their views? And suddenly 1933 gave them an opening, sort of let loose the boil or whatever, and gave them permission to express feelings that they'd had anyway. And when I read the impact of, we're going to talk about it in the second half, of some of the Islamophobic literature in Germany today, it almost seems as if it's always there and that the socialization has an impact on how much gets expressed and how much is permissible to express, but that they're almost the speed with which these three men came out as anti-Semites is just astonishing. When they'd had Jewish students, Kittel had a new Hebrew, he collaborated, he was a foremost collaborator with Protestant theologians. It's really depressing, I have to say. Any other comments before we look at another film that would have told Germans that Jews were not the only kinds of people to be pushed out of the Third Reich? And I think, by implication, this puts anti-Semitism in a broader category morally. So here's a film, The Victims of the Past, that popularized, this was a short film, Eternal Jew was a feature film. This is a short film, the Nazis did this very well. The kind of film that you would see between the coming attractions and the newsreel. You'd see a short like this. And so here is, I won't tell you what it's about, I'll just let it play. Oh, thank you. Again, it's a doctor, a medical doctor.
Alles Lebensschwache geht in der Natur unfehlbar zugrunde. Wir Menschen haben gegen dieses Gesetz der natürlichen Auslese in den letzten Jahrzehnten furchtbar gesündigt. Wir haben unwertes Leben nicht nur erhalten, wir haben ihm auch Vermehrung gewährt. Die Nachkommen dieser Kranken sahen so aus. Erbgesunde Menschen wohnten in engen, lichtlosen Gassen und halb verfallenen Lauben. Idioten und Schwachsinnigen baute man aber Paläste, und diese kranken Menschen waren gar nicht empfänglich für die Schönheit, mit der man sie umgab. Das deutsche Volk kennt das ganze Ausmaß dieses Elends wohl kaum. Es kennt nicht den drückenden Geist jener Häuser, in denen tausende lallende Schwachsinnige künstlich ernährt und gepflegt werden müssen, die tiefer stehen als jedes Tier. In den letzten 70 Jahren hat sich unser Volk um 50% vermehrt, während die Zahl der Erbkranken im gleichen Zeitraum um 450% gestiegen ist. Wenn diese Entwicklung so weiterliefe, würde schon in 50 Jahren auf 4 gesunde Menschen ein Erbkranker kommen. Ein endloser Zug des Grauens würde in die Nation hineinmarschieren. Maßloses Elend über ein wertvolles Volk kommen, das dann mit Riesenschritten seinem Ende entgegenginge.
So partly what these films do and caricatures do is expand the range of permissible speech. The German word is really nice for the salonfähig, that is appropriate for the parlor speech. And these films give us permission to stare. When I was growing up, if somebody was walking down the street, even if they'd broken their leg in a ski accident and had a cast, and I would say, oh, don't look. Don't make that person feel out of place. So we were told not to stare at the misbegotten. And this film reverses that, puts these people back in our view, and excludes them from the golden rule, I think. Have you ever seen images like this? What about this? How did they compare with the Jewish images? Any comments?
There's a lot of crowding. There's people moving around and yelling.
That's right, because they're collective. They don't have any individuality.
And they're growing and they're going to take over New York.
Yeah, they swarm.
It's like a zombie effect.
Like a zombie effect, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I think the gender dynamics are really interesting because you always have close-ups of men.
Yes.
And women and children are
right.
always in horde
right.
as part of the swarm,
right.
but it's
right.
the men that they're able to sort of make the
right.
story go with.
That's right, and the women and the children are just sort of hovering in the back. The anti-Semitic stereotype for the Nazis, the Judeo-phobic, see, I can't even do it. The Judeo-phobic stereotype was male. The predator Jewish male, whether he was a capitalist or a Bolshevik, didn't matter. Or a sex offender. That was the danger. Anything else on the gendering of the disabled? I kind of think they lost their male and female character. Didn't they? I mean, I'm not sure I'm right about that, but it seems to me that they kind of lost their individuality. Their, along with losing their individuality, they lost their maleness and femaleness.
Although you have
but,
the nurses in white, which are the...
Well, there. That's us, right. We, that's right, that's right. Well, oh, I see it. I was thinking it highlighted how we superior people have rigidly divided gender roles, and those people in a swamp kind of clumped together. But you're right about the crowding. They're always seething. More comments? Yeah.
One of the first sentences of the video was, "We human beings."
Yes.
And after that, it was this way in the other video as well. There's a distinct separation between we and they. And as you're watching, you associate yourself with the we, with the in crowd, and you're looking at the they that's very much on the outside. And starting
mm-hmm.
off with we human beings and clarifying the we as humanity, you not only create an insider and outsider, but create a humanity and a separation from humanity. And the visuals in that video were casting them as beasts, as something that, you know, when you look at a herd of animals, you don't necessarily think about gender. You don't think about individuality. It's a swarm, it's a herd, and the pictures themselves and made them just look more like beasts than human beings.
So if the eternal Jew was like a safari, this was like a zoo.
It seemed that way.
That
yeah.
we were looking in on, maybe. I couldn't resist showing them. As I said, gee, you know, you've all read the book. I can't remember what I wrote. No, I didn't say that. I reread it. And I'd like to talk more about the book, but I thought this is an opportunity to do something you can't do in writing.
Well, I'm German, and so I listen mostly.
Oh, you can hear the language.
Yeah, I could hear the language. And for me, it was totally clear in the first, in The Eternal Jew, the language was a quite soft language. Not the words, but the way it was spoken was more soft.
Uh-huh.
While in the second one, it was really harsh,
wasn't it?
But it also combines with the music in the background. And on the other side, it's like in The Eternal Jew, we have pictures from outside of Germany. We have the Warsaw Ghetto, while all these handicapped people would have been in Germany within. So we have the danger from the outside and the danger from the inside.
Different dangers, but to make Germans feel threatened. I think, but maybe I'm wrong, but I think, this is one of those things I don't think I'd write, but I think anyway. I think that there was a subtle message saying, if we can be hard on our own, if we can contemplate euthanasia, Sarah Palin would call them death panels, against ourselves, then that might, it's easier to do it against others. Maybe. I don't know. It's an easy question.
Hannah Arendt claims that the genocide on the disabled actually failed on the basis of
absolutely right.
of resistance by the Germans. And then the Jews were up next, and nobody protested against that.
That's right.
So that could be done. Is that actually true?
Yes. And in fact, the two bishops who wrote that protest letter in 1941 in the summer, Hitler almost never withdrew any order, but the secret, the SD reports from everywhere were reporting that people got worried. They said, if my son comes back from the Eastern Front with only one leg, is he going to be called a useless mouth? In other words, he takes food without putting enough back. Will he be subjected to euthanasia? And so the T4 became the source of many rumors. And both bishops used words that no German Christian used about the Jews. They used terms like our brothers, our fellow citizens. And I'm sure it wasn't deliberate, it's just the way they thought. So when they did issue pleas on behalf of the Jews, they didn't employ that language. But the two letters, the public letter, the sermon, I think of von Galen was a public sermon that circulated in the Catholic Church. I'm not sure the other one. I was going back to my former life. But that language of it could happen to us next, us Germans, didn't get spoken on behalf of the Jews. Because German Aryans didn't feel they could be next. But with euthanasia, they did.
But just to be clear, there were between 75,000 and 85,000 people killed in the T4 program.
Maybe even more, yeah.
Technological means of mass killings were developed in those experiments that made possible for larger genocide. So be careful how we describe it as a failure.
Right, and because Hitler never... And I would never say, nothing could have dissuaded anybody in the Nazi hierarchy from stopping the genocide. There's no question. That I don't want to say, no.
Right.
Just that the language of protest was different. But no, absolutely nothing could have stopped the extermination of the Jews. Nothing.
How can you say that?
Oh, what would have? I mean... After 1941, I think it was.
Okay.
But 1941, up until then, it wasn't clear.
Okay.
They didn't even deport people from France or Europe in 1940. They didn't really hatch the plan. We could go on, this is forever, couldn't we? We could keep them here for another 4 hours saying, did the order happen on the end of July in 1941, or did it happen after Pearl Harbor, or did it happen in the euphoria of victory or in the failure of defeat? But somewhere between the summer of 41 and the early part of 42, that's when it became inevitable. Nothing could have stopped it.
There would be an argument against that, but we could have another
time.
Okay.
Go ahead and have it now.
Yeah.
I think it's really dangerous to say that something was inevitable and couldn't have been stopped. I think that's a failure of imagination. It seems to me it was stopped at one point. It could have been stopped earlier.
We know in some places there were pauses, like the Bulgarians understood how to play on the corruption and the anti-Semitic fantasies and the anti-German feelings of their peoples. And the Romanians, the Jewish community was better mobilized. So we know at some places that it was changed and diverted. And we know that the Danes also managed to get all but 475 Jews out, and that is nearly 8,000, but we also know the Danes didn't accept any refugees in the 1930s. So that there are pockets of, it wasn't uniform. You could deflect it, you could delay it. I think you couldn't stop it. I mean, don't you ever feel like as an American citizen you'd like to stop something too? Yeah, Aaron, what do you...
I don't think that the idea is that it was inevitable in a sense of kind of a preordained process. But between the summer of 41 and the beginning of 42, so in the summer of 41, the Germans in Russia, in September, October, they already go back and they start to annihilate whole villages, including women and children, while before they only killed men. Then October, September, we have Babi Yar.
Yep.
33,000 people are being exterminated in 1.5 days. So still, the things could have been different. There is no doubt. But I think the Germans have already decided, I would think about it within the frame of the metaphor, a world without Jews. The Nazis decided, this world will have no Jews. Maybe we'll kill some of them in a war. Maybe we'll kill all of them in a war. Maybe we'll ship them to Madagascar so they're going to rot them there. But in our world, there will be no Jews. So I think it's not so. I think also historians say so. Whether the Holocaust was decided in October or in September or in December 41, my view is it's not the right way of framing the question. The right way of framing the question is how the Nazis could imagine a world without Jews. And my argument is that the Nazis and the Germans actually imagined a world without Jews in the pre-war years. Mm-hmm. It made the Holocaust possible.
Yeah.
That's you know, as you know, that's my project now. So I would put it in this way. It's not the...
Okay, are we nearing a break time about now? Okay, and I sure, and I'll just put up a couple. I'll put up a couple of really nasty caricatures up here.
And just to give you, this is thank you so much
For the nasty caricature. No,
we'll take about a 5-minute break.
Yeah,
we have
okay.
Coffee and beverage, and then we'll reconvene until 5:30. So we only have about half an hour.
Oh boy,
45 minutes after we take a short break. Some of you have asked. I guess the nearest bathrooms are Alderman Library. What? Is it open?
If you have a student ID.
We have a student ID.
I'll go grab it.
Okay, terrific.
Okay, here we go again. And so I'm going to make a transition very quickly and then maybe spend about 15, not even, I hope maybe 10 minutes, talking about one particular Islamophobic pair in Germany today, specifically about the best-selling book since Mein Kampf, which is right here. Of course, you know, the French Islamophobic books are all these little tiny little books that are barely books. They're more like pamphlets. The German books are solid. Every culture has its own traditions. And anyway, okay. So this is just to make an obvious point. That is, we think caricatures are just humor. They're funny. But they do accustom our eyes to extreme views, towards physiologizing cultural differences. These are three guys who are cuckoos. And they have laid their eggs in the nest of another bird and are going to be hatched. And I think we're not even going to bother translating. And here's another one. So many cartoons, these are all from the Stürmer, this terrible magazine, overtly racist magazine. So many cartoons, first of all, very few cartoons have females. Very few cartoons have children. And many cartoons that have females in them are on the theme of there are two different kinds of humans. So physically, they look different. There's the Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts, the Hitler Youth, walking on the horizon, and then the Rolls-Royce drivers here in the foreground, who are saying, I wonder why they're walking when they could be driving. It's a perfectly stupid cartoon. That's not my point, is that this is how racial thinking gets mainstreamed, I think we'd call it, into society. And we shouldn't be too surprised at the amount of parallels between Nazi anti-Semitism and Christian anti-Jewish pronouncements. This is from excerpts from the famous chart from Hilberg. Hilberg's Destruction of the European Jews, 1962, has a chart which I couldn't get it lined up right. You'll just have to forgive me. But Hilberg goes through about 12 different councils of the early Christian church, the prohibitions, and matches them with the equivalent Nazi prohibitions. There were over 400 separate laws against Jews, constricting Jews' movements and ultimately lives in the Third Reich. Anyway, this is the parallel done by Raoul Hilberg years ago. Okay, now let's move on. And the three Abrahamic religions are rivalrous. This is an architectural drawing, of course, of Jerusalem. They have the same cradle, the same crucible, and they are in competition. The Christians are chronologically faced with rivals both before them and after them, and need constantly to define the Christian's mission apart from their rivals. Now, is there a difference between racism and cultural essentialism? Yes, of course. But before this, let me just say, because this is really, I am not saying, what I want to try to do is learn something about Christianity. I do not want to say that Jews are like Muslims, or that fear of Jews is like the fear of Muslims in the real world. Never did Jews have transnational domination. Never did Jews control, never was Judaism the major religion in 57 countries of the world. Never did Jews promulgate a jihad against Christians or against Muslims. Never did Jewish theology promote the kind of misogyny that Islam, and some kinds of Orthodox Islam, well, I don't know though, those rabbis, those Orthodox rabbis in Jerusalem, I'm not sure. But I think they're the exception, not the rule. Anyway, so there are many, many differences between the two dangers and between the two religions. And the biggest difference between Nazi and Judeophobia and contemporary Islamophobia is that the Nazis used a racial language. Does that make a difference? Well, let's think about this. I think it does. Remember the Heinrich Himmler's Posen speech from 1943? It's the one everybody knows about, I don't care how many women die digging an anti-tank ditch. Well, okay. In that same speech, Himmler, in October 1943, warns his audience not to take the extermination of the Jews lightly. And he worried about Germans' humanity. He worried about Germans' humane instincts that might undercut the plans for total annihilation of the Jewish race. Germans, he said, would hear orders to kill Jews. And then, quote, "And then, along they all, the Germans, along they all come, all of the 80 million upright Germans, and each one has a decent Jew. They say all the others are swine, but here is a first-class Jew," unquote. And then, so today, so what I want to argue is the Nazis' goal, Hitler's goal, was to exterminate all people who had Jewish grandparents. They couldn't, conversion didn't matter. Islamophobia, being overtly cultural, is very different in that, in theory, and in fact, it's much more like Judeophobia used to be before that biological blip from the late 19th century to the mid 20th century. Before anti-Semitism or Judeophobia became biological racist, it was cultural, because the traditional Christian solution to the Jewish problem has been conversion. And that's the solution to the problem of Muslims in Europe today. So both of these racisms are discursively produced. Both depend on culture, but they're different languages and different strategies. And what the Islamophobic discourse does is to place the burden on the victim, because this language says, see, this is only your culture. If you wanted to convert to become secular like us, we would accept you. And in fact, we've accepted many, many Muslims who've left their family heritage behind. So that by giving the objects of prejudice the choice of denying their heritage, it's placing the blame for stigma on them and not on us. Moreover, those people who have, some of my best friends are Muslims, can say, I am not prejudiced. And so I want to talk today about the expert and the, I haven't thought of a name for her. I guess we call her the exception Muslim, like Hannah Arendt. Her name, first the expert. I'm sure you probably don't remember. In September 2010, am I right? Yeah, 2011. No, 2010. September 2010, a director of the German bank named Theo Sarrazin, which means pirate in Arabic, Thilo Sarrazin published a book in which he basically said all Muslims in Germany should leave or acculturate, and he expressed deep hostility to Muslims, saying on the cover of the blurb said, oh, here we pay for them to just go out and have lots of little headscarf babies. They're going to overpopulate, they're going to overcome the country. So let me do a quick rundown. And the image that around the icon for Islamophobia is not male, it's female. It would be terrorists, it is the Twin Towers collapsing, but you can't, the point of the terrorist is you can't recognize the terrorist. The terrorist is a member of a sleeper cell. Sleeper cell comes from biology. A sleeper cell is a cell that seems harmless until it erupts, and it's so dangerous you can't stop it. And that's that, like the germ metaphor, the parasite metaphor that is Nazi language is redolent with. So the woman who has no face is not transparent to us, but you can recognize her. So she, the female, becomes the image of a dual oppression that appeals to right-wing people and left-wing people and feminists. So on the one hand, she represents the hidden sleeper cells, obviously male terrorists, although there have been some women with suicide bombers. She's representing, she's the tip of the iceberg of a fanatic population in Europe that endangers mainstream society, Western civilization, but she also is oppressed by her Muslim patriarchy and therefore needs to be rescued. So she's both herself a victim and symbolic for aggression. And that gendering of the enemy is really important, I think. Anyway, and she has no face. What color are her eyes? She might be the worst traitor of all. She might be a convert. I have a whole chapter on converts. All right. In Germany and France, but not in England, best-seller books are these, after 9/11, are these unbelievable survivor narratives. They sound like ex-slave narratives. They sound like survivor narratives from the Gulag, from the Holocaust. These are stories of women who have had truly horrifying experiences and escaped from one form of male tyranny or another, from the Muslim world. And their covers all feature faceless women. And most of them have ghostwriters. Their European language ability isn't good enough for them to be on talk shows, but they are bestsellers. They're published by Respect, Knieper, and Vitch, Pipa. The good presses bring out their books. And these are just a few. This is a new one that I just heard of. Okay. And one of the great crusaders against Islam is Germany's feminist. Think Betty Friedan and multiply times 10. And you will come to Alice Schwarzer. This is the cover of her last book. So, okay, so, all right. This films are made about the other world, the secret world of Islam. Okay, before though, I want to say this. And I wish I had more knowledge. I have notes, but I can't remember them. I took them so long ago. That's a wonderful thing about a database. You think you've captured it? And they say, oh yeah, it's there, but it's not there. Anyway, the German clergy has been extraordinary in funding exchange, Muslim Christian exchange conversations. They have funded, I think I counted along with the states, that is the individual states, in the 1990s, about 120 20-minute to one-hour films were made showing Muslims and Germans living well together for community groups. The Germans were horrified at the outbreaks of racism in the early 90s after reunification. And so the German clergy has been outspoken in defense of women's right to wear headscarves, of Muslim equality, and they have been very much the opposite of the way they were under the Nazis. They've done the opposite of caving in. But this is the man who wrote this book. He's the director of the bank. He's an old 68er. He is an old-time socialist. He's been very active in the Socialist Party and the SPD. I think he got the bank job as a kind of a political plum. The outrage of this book led to his resignation as a bank director, but don't feel sorry for him. He couldn't find anyone to publish his book. He tried and he tried and he tried. And, oh, I guess this is a later edition. Oh, this is a Deutsche Verlagsanstalt. That's perfectly respectable. Okay. His first edition came out in an unknown press, and it sold a small number, and it ran through that printing, and by now, I don't know how many million. No, I think it's 1.5 million. In any case, no book since Mein Kampf has sold as many copies, and it's not cheap. It is a very German book. It's full of tables. Lots of statistics, population. It has theories about Muslim inferiority in the gene pool. Quotes Richard Herrnstein. Remember the bell curve from a few years ago? Argues that Muslims are genetically inferior to Germans, and that they should go home because they're costing the Germans too much money. And he is an economist after all. And the book here's just pages and pages of graphs and charts, and of course the footnotes. Okay. These are the footnotes. It's dense, it's scholarly, it's tightly argued, and it's filled with poisonous generalizations about Muslims. How can he get away with this? My thesis is that in Germany, like in Holland, you've heard of Ayan Hirsi Ali, remember her on the front page of Newsweek 3 weeks ago? She was warning about Christian genocide because of all. Ayan Hirsi Ali is the Dutch scholar who married our favorite historian at Harvard. And she is warning about genocide against Christians in the Middle East and got a full-length feature. She grew up Muslim, of course, escaped from it. And she's articulate. Five or six German women are also more than just plain survivors of their Muslim background. Actually, they have gone on, gotten advanced degrees, they're lawyers, they're respected. This one is a sociologist, and her name is Nechla Kelik. And everywhere Sarasin goes, this is Sarasin on a talk show, I think it might be the one that's called Hard But Fair in English, Hart Aber Fair. And everywhere Sarrazin goes, he goes with one of these, I call them survivor Muslims, who speak out with deep authenticity against the religion of their fathers. They are very powerful because they are speaking from their own experience. I can't think of a Jewish intellectual who ever took such liberty to criticize the religion of his faith. And I may be wrong on that, but there's a vehemence, a virulence in her hatred of Islam that is quite amazing. And then I thought there is a parallel. You heard of an American bestseller called The 19th Wife? Mormon women who have escaped from Mormonism tell a similar kind of story. And so these women, these exception Muslim women, are making it respectable for non-Muslims to criticize Muslims. And if you think about Oriana Fallaci, who at the time she died, quite a few years ago, was being brought up on charges of racism in Italy. Nechla Kelik quotes her And Nechtle Kellich wins prizes. The Naumann Stiftung Prize 1 year, one person every year, every 2 years, gets this prize for advancing democratic values. So she, because she was born a Muslim, can criticize Islam with impunity, whereas outspoken non-Muslims get accused of racism. And so just, this is an example. This is a birth dearth graph. They've got loads and loads of graphs showing the downward trajectory of European births. And there's the talk show. And so let's just, and I'm just going to show a couple minutes of it, just to show you how Sarrazin himself is a wild speaker. He's very dramatic. He's very funny. Listen, Nechtle Kellich is every bit the prof. Really boring, but she does her job. And here she is recommending Sarrazin's. Oh, no, wait a minute. Go back. Hold on. Where are you? There you are. Okay.
Ich möchte Ihnen ein Buch vorstellen, das heute erscheint und
über
das
sich recommend a book.
Das politische Berlin offenbar bereits eine abschließende Meinung gebildet hat. Allen anderen, die nicht nach Vorurteilen streben, also ihnen.
The point is that she goes through all of Sarrazin's arguments and makes them respectable because they're coming from the mouth of a Muslim. And then I thought I would close with just one cartoon. There are lots of cartoons. This is not a particularly vicious one. In our world, we don't tolerate those kinds of vicious cartoons like they used to. Anyway, I would like to then close with a quotation, I think, about goodness that is worth remembering. Todorov, about 10 years ago, said, a maxim for the 21st century might well be to start not by fighting evil in the name of good, but by attacking the certainties of people who claim always to know where good and evil are to be found. Now we have little time to talk.
From the book as well, but this is much more succinct. I kind of picked up on the sort of feeling, and I guess my biggest question is, how do we construct or hope to construct some sort of universal human rights, some sort of kind of, how can you have that when we're in some ways backing away from certainty about good and evil?
I feel very strongly about this. I think that we have betrayed, the European Court of Human Rights has betrayed the rights of Muslim women. I believe in universal human rights, and I think we can construct them, but what we have to do, Alan Wolf just wrote a book called Political Evil, which doesn't have a lot that's very original in it, but one of his ideas I thought was good. And that is, he said, what we tend to do, he was talking about the evildoer, the man who talked, our president who talked about the evildoer, we tend in our prejudices to conglomerate all evil and put it on the ethnic group. And he said, what we should do is disaggregate it, to take apart the group that we're prejudiced against. And so I think that the case for universal human rights has to be made in each individual right, and not trying to argue philosophically about whether, for example, I do not agree with Muslim scholars who say that the founders of feminism and human rights in the 1920s and 30s fought for human rights while accepting their inferiority as wives. To me, that doesn't count. I have Muslim friends who think it does, who think that that's part of universal human rights. Does that come near sort of your question? I think it's a project we have to work on. But it's not easy, and I get in a lot of arguments.
Well, I guess kind of, so
yeah.
Are there things we can be certain about? And how do you, I mean, it seems dangerous to me to back away to back away from certainty in some areas. I mean, who are the people that kind of that make the stand against the...
Okay, let me give you one example. You would think that the European Court of Human Rights would be the place where Muslim women would have their rights upheld. The European Court of Human Rights is getting stronger every year. It overturned British rights on gays in the military. It overturned part of their security law. It now told, just last a few months ago, the UNHCR imposed, I don't mean UNHCR, European Court of Human Rights, ECHR, told Britain that prisoners had to vote, and they've been overriding national sovereignty left and right, but they do not uphold the right of a woman Muslim to cover her head. Because they say, and this is how universal human rights are used to end the human rights of Muslims, that is, of people not like us. They say that the woman wearing the headscarf has, by putting the scarf on her head, exempted herself from autonomy, and therefore she doesn't have access to human rights. And feminists, by and large in France, not so much in Germany, agree. These are feminists who believe that you should take a woman seriously when she says, I want an abortion, or I'd like to use birth control. Feminists say, believe the woman. But when she wears a headscarf, they say she's got false consciousness and exempts herself from human rights. So that's the example of what I mean by case by case. Is that? How, and it's messy because it isn't big and philosophical. It's nitty gritty and it's fought in the language of the law, which I want to tell you is really boring.
Other questions?
How about in this country? What about visual? I mean, you all know who Joseph Kony is, right? I mean, we have...
Yeah. I just, one question on the video clip you showed. I don't know what this Muslim woman was going to say in this German talk show, and if she were there simply to endorse these biological claims of the book. That's one thing. But if she's there to offer a testimonial of sorts of women in a repressive Muslim home or culture, why assume she's a prop and not a Rosa Parks? And I ask that because when we were living in Berlin a couple of years ago, there was a very fashionable T-shirt that Islamic feminists in neighborhoods like Prince Albert Bay were wearing, and it was in Arabic, "Where's Rosa?" It was this picture of Rosa Parks.
Oh, interesting.
Sort of making an identification.
I would have thought Rosa Luxemburg. Oh, well.
And the American Civil Rights Movement. So the question is, you called her a prop, but if she is speaking out of the same kind of emancipatory premises that all of our great heralded freedom movements trade on, then... how would you discriminate between that discourse and the discourse of the prop?
She is discrediting any woman who wears a headscarf on the face of it. And said, this is a dangerous woman. They don't know how to be happy. She goes on and on in this particular clip. And Muslims' definition of happiness is different from ours. How they spend their money is different. They have better schools. It sounds like Opfer der Vergangenheit. Their schools have a higher student-teacher ratio because we try to favor these schools, and the Muslim kids don't behave, and they're having too many babies, and they depend on welfare. So that she goes beyond defending the rights of women who are objectively terribly treated in their family. And she goes on the offensive against Islam. Rather than some of the more moderate of her fellow feminists are lawyers who have, actually one was nearly assassinated by an angry father, who are really working very hard to help women get out from under, get restraining orders, get them into battered women's shelters, etc. But she's going the whole way in the other direction. And just condemning, so that you can quote Nechla Kellich and say things that you wouldn't be able to say yourself. You have to ventriloquize her. And the debate is being boiled down. How surprised are we in this country? The debate is being boiled down to its most, to its crudest level. I mean, I know they don't have a year-long campaign in Germany to do this, but I'm really troubled by the degradation of political thinking in this country and in the Muslim debate. I got to say, though, the by and large, the clergy is solidly behind Muslim rights and interfaith dialogue, and they do not have this kind of American fundamentalist version, the American fundamentalists who are in love with Israel. That is no counterpart.
Can you say more about that? The differences. And I say that because I'm taking this feminist thought class this semester, and I just read a book a few weeks ago titled The Politics of Piety by Saba Mahmoud. Right.
There's somebody who got swept away by her informants, I think.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yeah, I do.
But in some sort of way in the book...
She's very smart.
Right. But she's trying to articulate a different way of thinking about how these women actually do have agency and autonomy.
Right.
And the veil isn't something that's oppressive, but it's something that, in her, what she's getting from them might be what is a sign of virtue and creates virtue.
Right. You can imagine. I wrote a book on Nazi women. I read this book, and I thought, oh, my God, that's like these Nazis who said, we're really feminists. We have our separate sphere. You know, Kinderkirchen, Kirchen, let's take over Kultur. Let's have our own separate sphere. That's Saba Mahmoud, because she knows it's totally impossible to have any rights in the public sphere.
Uh-huh.
And so she is defending these women who are doing something very noble, which is reading the Quran themselves and prayer meetings. But I don't call that feminism.
Well, yeah, that's a different conversation, I guess. But I was thinking in terms of a more recent book that I just read was called Expanding the Palace of Torah. And it's a feminist book, and she's talking about how women operate in Orthodox Judaism. And in reading the two books right near each other, I just kept being reminded of how, in some sort of way, Orthodox Jewish women are not politicized. Their bodies are not being exploited or used for, you know, book covers or talking about their oppression, at least not in the mainstream world. But the bodies of Muslim women in places like, you know, the Middle East are. Mm-hmm. So I was just trying to figure out, I wanted you to say more about why that's the case. Why is it that this body is the one we want to talk about and not necessarily a Jewish Israeli body?
Well, there are virtually no Jews in Europe. But there are about 5 to 6%, depending on how you count them, and they're a growing percentage. And Europe is a mono-ethnic place. The welfare state worked because everybody belonged to the same ethnic group. And when people not like themselves, especially with who are hidden and obscure, begin to come to need social services, the welfare nets. Phrase. I think it's one reason why social welfare state never happened in the United States and happened there, so it's falling apart. But I don't know enough about Judaism to answer that question. Maybe somebody else here does. But there's certainly in mind, I don't see anywhere the rage against Judaism among women who used to be Jewish. And I don't know why the English language press doesn't pick up these books. There's Betty Mahmoudi, Not Without My Daughter. That's huge. And Mukhtar Mai, a Pakistani woman who publishes in English. So in English, there are books by women outside of Europe who've escaped from their Muslim family and Muslim feminists. But I have yet to... And there's one Canadian anti-Muslim, ex-Muslim, whatever.
Okay.
But the genre is really hot in France and Germany.
I have one more question.
Is what?
I don't need it. I don't have to be the... You can... No, you do it.
Do you have a question?
Yeah.
Okay, this is going to be the last question, sadly.
Oh, that's enough to really put you at your ease, isn't it?
It's been a really fruitful exchange, so thanks again for...
question.
Wow. Oh, in case you just relax, yeah.
Well, first of all, thank you for the talk. I thought it was really wonderful. We were in a class on science and politics, learning about Nazi Germany and the takeover, and thinking about questions of eugenics. So, right on par with all we've been talking about. Out of curiosity, the quote you have on the screen, is it fair to summarize that as sort of an anti-fundamentalist need for the 21st century? Mm-hmm. I guess my concern, and I don't normally study these topics, but an anti-fundamentalist turn would mean that people would sort of turn from their beliefs, and I guess my feeling is that consequently they would have to turn their beliefs to sort of the idea for this would be, I suppose, to unify everybody on a national or sort of global level. And the second you do that, though, the second people turn from their core beliefs, I feel like they have to turn to something, and presumably that would be towards whoever's in charge, the government, whatever those governmental ideals are. And I guess I feel like in Nazi Germany, it was that same anti-fundamentalism amongst the people, where Hitler was, you know, first against the Jews, and then at one point he was sort of outspoken against Christianity.
A lot.
And I guess it was, you know, over the course of a decade, what this turned into is that everybody was now looking up towards the leadership, and it just puts a whole bunch of power in who's ever in charge, and it's equally dangerous as if there are, you know, fundamentalists running around.
So who is the fundamentalist then? Would be Hitler the fundamentalist, or the Christians would be fundamentalist?
Well, I think that it's sort of, you've got fundamentalism on both ends, where on the one side you have fundamentalism, different groups sort of checking and balancing one another, and I see that as a safeguard. On the flip side is if you fight against that, ultimately the more you unify, the more power there is for one fundamentalist group to...
See, I don't see that. I see this as Todorov is saying, just be self-critical. Back away. When you think you know something for sure, back away. And his challenge is for us to be able to handle complexity without losing our fundamental values, to be able to have the toleration to work our way through a complex argument and not shy away from it. Because in the end, we'll defend our real beliefs better if we're constantly alert to the possibility that they may be misdirected. So I think he's asking for us to be, for us to self-scrutinize. I don't think he means to put power in the hands of anybody. I think that's what he's afraid of.
Well, thanks so much again, and I'm encouraged to go and develop my own suspicion that the Kantians and not the Barthians were the ones who could see most clearly in the 1930s, but that's for another day, and thank you again for sharing your time with us.
Oh, thank all of you. Okay.